You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online, jackiedaily.com, on Facebook and on Twitter at Jackie Daily Host, and subscribe for free. iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, The Blaze, and others. I am very happy to tell you that my friend David Reboy will be joining me this show. He is the brains behind a website. Well, it's on Substack, but it's called Late Republic Nonsense. Late Republic Nonsense. He had an article that really made the rounds. I'm sure you've seen it and heard it on conservative talk because they got to him first, because I only make a show once a week, so I had to wait my turn. But the title is National Divorce is Expensive, but it's Worth Every Penny. Again, National Divorce is Expensive, but it's Worth Every Penny. Subtitle: The National Divorce Discussion Prepares the Ground for Crucial Thinking About What Comes Next in America as the country grows ever more divided, bitter, and angry. David is a political warfare, that is, propaganda consultant. I would call him, he might disagree. Politico calls him a Twitter right-wing pugilist. And he's a jazz musician. Little known fact, he has a long history with the Jackie Daily Show. In fact, he was with it about as long as I've been, way, way, way back in its embryonic phases. In 2014, David helped me out with writing some scripts for the show. I don't have scripts anymore. They all come right from the heart. I don't script anything, but he did an amazing job and really was part of the support network back when we first started. And so, to give you an idea, you know, I started out the interview, I was writing the questions, and I'm like, you know what, national divorce, what do you mean by that? Are we talking about a civil war? Spoiler alert, no. David seems to think there is a peaceful way to become, two different cultural and economic zones. In other words, each side can become culturally and economically autonomous. And I'm a little skeptical because I think that the government has a way of rigging the system, trumping any effort to let the free market work it out. So for example, if Twitter wants to turn off half the country with how it treats those who don't share their views, under normal circumstances, what would happen is a competitor would rise up and say, hey, 150 million Americans and others around the world, we'll take you. Come over here. But if there is no rule of law, if antitrust laws are not enforced, if Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is not in fact addressed, you know, because there are legal ways to get at this, then how do you fix that? If there's a breakdown of the rule of law, it doesn't matter what laws you pass. And it doesn't matter that you went into court if the courts will not properly apply the law. So anyway, we talk about what the future could look like and the fact that ideas are the most important thing among people. So you either believe in the rule of law or you don't. You believe in personal responsibility or you don't. And you know, you believe in a higher power or you don't. You believe in personal responsibility or you don't. Which is how I started a speech out in Midland at the Petroleum Club many years ago. The future of a people is determined by the ideas that they as a group hold. There are lots of interesting books out there that I've enjoyed, like Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, Peter Zeigan's The Absent Superpower, or The Accidental Superpower. Zeihan, rather, was his last name. These are amazing books that tell a history or story of how humans come to be how they are without going into the ideas. I think the ideas are the critical piece, the critical part. And so, you know, if a bank wants to go woke and say, we're not going to finance oil and gas, that's a big opening for another bank to say, we'll take that business. But under the world I'm envisioning, the government has a way of interfering with that natural process. Anyway, David and I will talk about it. And I'm not sure if it's a hopeful segment or not. But if you haven't read it, I encourage you, check it out. National divorce is expensive, but it's worth every penny. Okay, before I go anywhere else, I want to tell you that the Women's Energy Network, WEN, W-E-N, Women's Energy Network, is having the annual leadership conference here in Dallas next week, and it's on Thursday, October 21st. And so, hey, you must, if you are in the energy industry and you're a woman, or you are a student and you want to be in the industry, I strongly encourage you to get involved with this group. This is a great networking group. This is how you meet the people in all the key places in banking, finance, operations, legal, human resources, whatever it is. If they're touching the energy industry, and historically that meant oil and gas, but these days I think it's expanding a little into other areas of energy. This is a great group. And there are chapters around the country, by the way. I'm just right here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And check it out. Just go online, Google Women's Energy Network. Look for your chapter. They have one in the Marcellus region, you know, Louisiana, Colorado. Basically, it's kind of like grouped around the shale plays. Think of it that way. And so the leadership conference is, it's not really an oil and gas conference. It's more like leadership philosophy and how women can take full advantage of opportunities that are available in really a sector where women have not been very heavily represented at all, but more so as the days go on, especially in the white collar sector or part of the sector. So, again, Women's Energy Network, check that out. I want to tell you that I've been thinking a lot lately about coal and oil and gas prices. I've been telling you the past few shows about how the prices are soaring because it seems to me the old expression, it was the rubber is meeting the road right now for these commodities. You have two very stark conflicting realities. Number one, major economies, whether it's the European Union, China, India, or the US or whoever, major economies are at very, very low rates of reserves or storage for these forms of energy that they've relied upon for, you know, over a century to survive, to have an economy, to feed their people. And at the same time, you have the financial sector warring against fossil fuels, that's coal, oil, and gas, for obvious reasons to do with the climate change debate. So all of these institutions are divesting from the production of these fossil fuels, while at the same time, countries are running up on a severe shortage. And when I say severe, I'm talking about shelves going empty in Europe or perhaps in the UK, as we saw in the press reports last week, and or worse, actually, in other countries, especially that are more poor, frankly. And so what's going to happen? I mean, right now, the prices of these commodities are being driven up because they're more scarce, because we're producing less, because we're financing less. And so the people who do produce them are making more money. Some people think it's an interesting time to be investing in energy. Uranium is going up right now. I feel like this is a moment. Like we're coming right up on a moment in the next year, especially this winter, where we're going to come to some reality about the talk versus the walk. Because these countries are not going to permit their people to go hungry or to freeze to death for lack of natural gas or coal. But we can't have those things if they're not being financed or if they're being politically shut down. So what is going to happen? I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. At the end of the day, we're going to continue using these fuels until there's an alternative. Surely, we are not going to make people suffer without food or heat on a mass scale in the name of a political mandate. Or perhaps the political sentiment will change dramatically when someone's on their fifth day of no heat in the middle of the winter. It's going to be interesting. I'm just telling you, I see this happening. I mean, I read the Wall Street Journal religiously. I'm looking at an article, Climate Bets Lift Commodities, on and on. And then I'm reading another article about how, China is building more coal plants than anyone else. That's not going to stop. We should not expect them to harm their people. And they're not the only ones, by the way. I think there's 30 different countries right now building coal plants. There are fewer in the pipeline, but they're happening. So with all this in mind, keep this in mind as you hear the talking heads in the press who don't know anything about energy telling you how woke they are. Let's see how woke they look 6 months from now. Already, you have California walking it back on their natural gas shutdown. So stay tuned. I have to go to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Find me online, jackiedaly.com, on Facebook and on Twitter at Jackie Daly Host, and subscribe for free, iHeartRadio, iTunes, and most other places where quality podcasts are found. So, in studio, I just poached him in the hallway. Coming from the Glenn Beck Show is David Reboy. David Reboy, you might know, especially if you are one of those devout Twitter users that lives in the Twitter sphere. He has operation called Late Republic Nonsense. Late Republic Nonsense. And he is a political warfare specialist, a propaganda specialist, an historian of sorts, a jazz musician. In little known fact, he has a long history with Jackie Daly Show. He actually wrote some early scripts for Jackie Daly Show, which were fantastic. If you didn't hear them, they're up. They're on the podcast from 2014.
Golden oldies.
Yeah, so back when we were on KLIF in the early days of The Blaze, a long time ago. And so we're so happy to have him back in person in Dallas. David, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here. Great to finally be on the show.
I know. Well, yeah. You live so far away. I'm not going to tell you where he lives for security purposes. This is a man who is practically in the witness protection program. But he's, because he's a highly valuable national asset. And really kind of thinks through.
Somewhere in South Florida.
Yeah. A free state, of course. Of course. And previous to that, lived in the free state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fair to say that your article, one of your latest posts, probably was one of the biggest stories, according to Dan Bongino, and he knows, he's smart, in America.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Even her.
Retweeted it, and Glenn Beck was talking about it, and it seems like the time has come for this issue.
Well, it's titled, National Divorce is Expensive, comma, but it's worth every penny. I thought I was running around with my father-in-law's circle of friends. I was like, this is a conversation I've heard before. But this one is about national divorce, and seriously, true story, I just came back from Los Angeles yesterday, and spontaneously, as I'm in a lobby checking out, the entire staff start talking about this topic.
Hmm.
Yes. And to my surprise, this was a group of six Californians who were extremely concerned that the country's coming apart and they had better get out of California. I mean, all six of them, I assume they're not politically homogenous. I don't know. But this is a conversation that now everyone's having. Everyone's happy. There's no place, even Los Angeles. This is a very, very liberal bastion I was in yesterday. So I chatted them up, and basically they were despondent and in despair. They're like, what are we going to do? Clearly, we have limited time here. And they didn't even know who I was, you know? And I didn't tell them that I do a podcast or anything. I just wanted to hear what they had to say. So the point is, even in LA, people are like, okay, how much time do we have left with the Republic as we know it? So I want to ask you, because I've read every syllable very carefully. When I first saw the title, I thought to myself, a divorce. One of my favorite fantasies is a national divorce. I would love that so much.
Well, we started talking about this. We talked about this, you and I, easily 10 years ago.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Easily
prescient.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we've kind of been on this on this topic for quite a while.
But today we would see it differently, far differently than we did 10 years ago.
I think that's true.
As you like to say, you say, what time is it?
Right.
Is your expression for this. And so go ahead and first define. You say national divorce. To some people, you know, if the feds are listening, like, is this guy ginning up a civil war? What is he talking about? So define national divorce.
Sure. Well, as I said in the piece, I think the first concept is that we very clearly do not see eye to eye on the most crucial things. You know, the most crucial things, you know, the meaning of justice, the biological reality or unreality, the ability to define reality, the relationship between the government and the citizen. All of these things are, you know, not just, you know, they're mutually exclusive definitions on, let's say, the red state side and the blue state side. And, you know, I'm not even at the point where I want to argue with the blue state side. I'm like, okay, you have your opinion. Great. Have fun. I just don't want to be ruled by them.
Right.
You know, and, you know, so we recognize that that's a thing that, because these issues are so foundational, that's not going to change. You know, there's no, I mean, occasionally you'll see people talking about how we need to end the polarization in America. It's like anyone who says that has no idea what they're talking about. It, you know, anyone who says that really has no conception of the ideas that are behind all these things. You know, it's not just an issue, you know, even a huge issue like abortion or taxes or anything like that. It's absolutely fundamental to how we understand human nature. I mean, the justice one, I think, is the biggest one because, you know, on one side, on let's say on our side, the red state side, we say equal justice under the law. Justice is blind. And, you know, that's how we go. In blue America, well, we've got to take into account your race or ethnicity or gender or, you know, 16 other different variables before we can figure out whether or not you are worthy of justice.
Right.
And this is a thing that's, you know, as I said, mutually exclusive. You can't have, you've got to have one or the other. And rather than have one or the other fight it out increasingly bitterly, I talk about national divorce, which is like we just stay away from one another. Maybe we dissolve the country. Maybe we don't. Maybe we figure out, you know, alternative strategies. And I think the alternative strategy that I like and really is the only one that has any kind of viability is the one that's centered on creating autonomous life. Autonomous, you know, public and private life, economic life, cultural life for Red America, enabling us to do things. Because we're in a world where, you know, we've got, you know, Chase Bank saying, no, I'm not going to do business with you if you hold, you know, XYZ opinions. We have people being canceled all over the place for, you know, for their political opinions. I mean, right now we have a scenario where vaccine mandates are being enforced through private businesses. We've got the big tech issue, which is big tech basically has, you know, the political conversation in America happens via technology, via, you know, these instruments that big tech has created. So to say, okay, these are just private companies, gives them far too much power. So we're in a position where the government itself doesn't have to, the blue state ethos is so strong that it doesn't have to come from the government. It's basically subsumed all of, American cultural, educational, economic life. So we need all of these things ourselves in order to survive the way we want and to live the kind of lives that we want.
Okay, so as I'm thinking this through, here's where I'm coming to. Because as you know, I talk a lot about oil and gas, which is being systematically defunded right now. Like more than half of American banks are saying, we're not going to bank fossil fuels anymore. And I would say way beyond half. To be green and woke. Well, my first thought would be, okay, fine. The first bank to bust out and say, we'll get a ton of business, especially at a time like now. Oil prices soaring. Natural gas prices soaring. Very profitable. Like, the natural way the market would work is, like, there's a great niche for that. Or just like, you know what? Y'all want to have anti-smoking, non-smoking bars? The smoking bar can put their hand up and say, we'll take your business. So, see, at first I go to that. But here's the problem. What happens when you have an unscrupulous government that doesn't care about the rule of law, does not care about the Constitution, the courts, anybody? And they simply say by fiat, one way or another, they've got lots of carrots and sticks. Sorry, free market bank, free thinking bank. You want to step out and do this? Here's what we have in store for you, right? So there's going to be, if it were just the corporations on an equal footing, I can see how the autonomy works for sure. If the government, however, can trump one way or another, or even just carrot and stick it, you know, then, for example, you do things we don't like, we will suddenly launch a Department of Justice investigation on you for antitrust or something. Mm-hmm. We'll come up with something to antagonize you. So, actually, I have to cut to break and don't have a choice. That is my question when we come back from break to David Reboy. Again, David of Late Republic Nonsense. Look it up on Twitter, Late Republic Nonsense. We're talking about national divorce is expensive, but it's worth every penny. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm having a conversation with David Reboy. David is the brains behind Late Republic Nonsense. Late Republic Nonsense. Find it on Twitter. And he's discussing with us today his very widely circulated piece titled National Divorce is Expensive, but it's Worth Every Penny. Again, National Divorce is Expensive, but it's Worth Every Penny. Before we went to break, David was saying the ideal, perhaps, for what comes next in a divided country is that we establish autonomy. So culturally, economically, in other words, fine. Twitter, you don't want half the country participating on your platform? That's fine. Someone else can rise up and offer an alternative. Or bank, you don't want to bank fossil fuels because you want to be woke? Fine. This bank over here, we'll have our own banks, and they'll do what we think is important, and we will therefore hopefully peacefully coexist. I think in an America with the rule of law and a government that respects the law, that works pretty well, actually. My concern, as I said before going to break, is that when the government is on the oppressive side and doesn't care about the law is the bottom line, what do we do when the government starts antagonizing those free banks or free platforms by finding ways? It could either be directly, like, how you get government funds to incentivize you to do what we want, or it can be, we don't like you. I think the IRS will audit you this year,
mm-hmm.
or the Department of Justice will find a reason to open an investigation. And, you know, that doesn't mean you'll be prosecuted. It doesn't mean you're going to be put in a cage, but it probably means you'll spend...
It'll just ruin your year.
It'll ruin right. your balance sheet. You'll spend yeah. tens of billions of dollars defending yourself against nothing, and your reputation's ruined kind of thing. So right. what about that?
So that's a huge issue. And on the other side of the issue, in addition to all of that, you've got the other private companies, which are in a kind of, you know, we could say they're in an ideological cartel, which is what happened to Parler. The government didn't have to do anything. Amazon Web Services shut down Parler's ability to operate, as did, you know, let's say, you know, 5 or 10 different companies down the, you know, the information supply chain that enables a company to do business. So we can see other companies doing this to curry favor with the government, and the government doesn't have to do anything. But to your example, yeah, I mean, they can make life very, very hard for, let's say, you know, red state, autonomous-based companies that start up. But that kind of underlines the importance of having strong local and state leaders who can go toe-to-toe with the federal government, you know, in court and elsewhere, you know, probably half in court and half in the court of public opinion, to protect these companies. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what's going to happen. I mean, I do take a kind of, in general, I take a kind of, I don't want to say fatalistic, but let's say realistic look at the country, and I say, well, you know, nothing can go on forever.
Right.
And I think this is a point that is really not appreciated by enough by people who are, you know, our age, or, you know, Gen X and baby boomers. And, you know, we all grew up thinking that, you know, the shining city on the hill is a religious idea. It will be around forever. It's the kingdom of heaven in perpetuity.
Yeah.
And that is not the ways of man. You know, there's no, there's a cycle of regimes. You know, there's no guarantee that this is forever. Actually, there is a guarantee that it's not forever.
That's right.
And so once we sort of assimilate that idea, we come to realize that we're going to get national divorce one way or the other. I'm not saying tomorrow, I'm not saying next week, or even within our lifetimes, but it's a thing that's going to happen once this place collapses.
Well,
it's going to happen on its own. So if you believe that, then I think it's paramount to develop these institutions that are more reflective of your values, just for no other reason than to be able to continue working. I mean, we talk about, you know, let's say, I mean, I think right now, you know, you brought up the issue of Twitter, and we have Facebook, and we have these other kind of big tech companies. This is where the political conversation in America exists.
Right.
It's no longer, you know, I mean, sure, you can go and you can put up a sign in your front yard that says, you know, Biden sucks, or like, you know, build the wall. But you're irrelevant to the political conversation completely if you're not in, you know, in this environment. You know, we're past the televisual age. We're now in the digital age. This is how this stuff works. And the ability of these companies to sort of together with the government, because it is a shared ideological cartel between all of them, to stifle political discussion is, I mean, I think that's the most worrying thing that I can imagine in my lifetime. I mean, people talk about COVID and all this stuff. I think that's much scarier.
Yeah, me too.
Because, you know, it's not about you being able to talk about, you know, or your grandma being able to post, you know, the equivalent of email forwards or whatever. But, you know, they have the ability to stifle the discussion. And once you stifle the discussion, you control what people are allowed to say, you necessarily will control what people think.
Well,
and this is the world that we've entered. And it's going in this direction unless we stop it.
I always said when I was working on Capitol Hill as a lawyer, focusing on the subcommittee on the Constitution and otherwise studying the Constitution even now regularly for my job and for consulting, I always said the First Amendment is the tools in the toolbox. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right to petition your government for redress of grievances, that means go to court or other things, as long as the tools in the toolbox are secure and strong, whatever goes wrong anywhere else with the other amendments or the Constitution, you can fix it. We can fix it. But here, if you're not able to speak in the forums where there are people to hear you, then you're shutting down the tools. And that would be, for example, typically an antitrust violation. I try to argue, and I see my law school classmates arguing a lot because there are so many they're in great positions now in amazing places. We have this fight about, okay, is big tech a public forum? And so I'm saying, let's be serious. You can't run for office and win unless you can get on these platforms. You can't reach people the way you used to without them. Therefore, and that's a civic critical element of our republic. Like, anyone who wants to has to be able to run, and we have to be able to vote for that person, and they have to be able to speak. So anyway, you get into these discussions, and there's a very good argument, and we're all familiar with the public platform versus publisher thing. In the courts, there's actually a fighting chance to do something about this, either under antitrust law or just over 230 of the Communications Decency Act. In my eyes, for this particular problem, that's where the hope lies. But as you know, you've got an administration that claims they're going to pack the courts. And you know what? I'm not sure there's a real limit to what they'll do, or at least try to do, whether it's constitutional or not. I don't see much regard for limits. Which takes us to a different part of the conversation, which is this. Such with election law and other things, it doesn't much matter what laws we pass if no one's going to enforce them. It just doesn't matter. You know, Ben Franklin said, this republic is suited to an educated and moral, or in other places, Christian or religious citizenry, and is fit for no other. And when we cease to be this...
Right. He meant virtuous.
Yeah. And when we cease to be this, it will end. It's a republic if you can keep it. So, at some level, the discussion we're having actually seems dependent on the intangible things that live inside us, which is what you say in your article. It's about ideas. You point to Alan Bloom. These intangible things that all of us kind of get a vote, right? Because we all decide what we believe. And therefore, in the aggregate, we have a belief, a norm.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I have to cut to break. I don't have a choice. When we come back, I want to pick up there with David Reboy. Check him out on Twitter. What is your Twitter handle?
Dave Reboy.
Okay, Dave Reboy.
On Twitter. DaveReaboi.
Yes. Late Republic nonsense. We're talking about national divorce is expensive, but it's worth every penny. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with David Reboy. You can find him on Twitter, as you should, because Politico says, what, you're the right-wing pugilist?
I'm like, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah, you should.
I think speaking of national divorce, as we're talking about, one of the symptoms, and I think one of the late Republic nonsense symptoms, is that we can be completely honest, sort of both sides, left and right, and present our case in a pretty straightforward way, and it will just outrage the other side.
Yeah.
And, you know, there it used to be that they would, that let's say the media and the left would smear folks on the right. These days, most of what they do is just present what we believe honestly, and they're so outraged by it. They think it's, you know, they think it's just insanity. I mean, yes, it was conventional wisdom for the last, you know, several centuries.
Years. Yeah.
Right. But now it's hate speech and crazy. And the way they present it, I think, and this sort of feeds into this, you know, feeds into the larger topic and to the issue of polarization. Because when, you know, and you know, in political warfare, you're sending out one message to your people, and 50% are hearing one thing, 50% are hearing, you know, the exact opposite. And if the if your adversary is repeating your message, it's the same thing. So it's, I mean, what it ends up doing is it just ends up increasing that polarization.
Well, and, you know, I was reading your piece, and the one part that I kind of sort of disagreed with, but not in effect, was this. You talk about the polarization, and there are days, David, when I think, you know what? Actually, we're not that different, except for the very ends, the 10% that are farthest to one side and the 10% that are farthest to the other side. Most of the people in the middle, frankly, they're not like us. They don't live, eat, breathe, sleep this stuff. They don't know what Russell Kirk said. They can't quote a Ronald Reagan speech, maybe a word or a phrase. They're just not steeped in what's happening. And if you talk to them, they all want the same things. They just have radically different ideas of how to get there because, in my eyes, number one, the two sides have different life experiences, but more importantly, different information sets put in front of them. So if you and I were a blank slate and were raised up on Rachel Maddow and Don Lemon or whoever he is, I'm not sure what we would think. But I'm saying most people, even now, have a lot in common. Here's my fear and where I meet up with you. I would bet you, if we look back through recent 20th and 21st century revolutions, we would find the same thing. It's not really that everybody's, or 50% are crazy. They weren't really crazy. They were deceived. They were checked out. They didn't have power. And it's really the ends that are fighting it out ideologically for the institutions, for the culture. And I feel like maybe, like I was saying a couple of shows ago, we might be the first civilization to die of stupidity. And then I thought, you know what?
Oh, 100%.
Well, I thought that for like 10 minutes. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe they all died of stupidity.
Right.
You know, like maybe the problem is not that people are so bad. I don't think people opposite me probably are so bad.
It's that people are people.
I think they believe a lot of lies about the messengers on the other side. And that's okay if we're disagreeing about, does supply-side economics work? It's not okay if we're discussing, is half the population evil?
Right.
That's different, you know?
Yeah, no, look, I agree with you completely. I think, though, that there is, let's say, addressing the population that you're talking about. So you're not talking about the people like us who are steeped in this stuff. You're talking about the people who would consider themselves either centrist or apolitical or whatever.
Well, they might even say they're Democrat or Republican.
Yeah.
But they vote by these little catchphrases.
They're not committed.
Yeah, like the Democrats for the working man.
Right.
That's as sophisticated as it gets.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So for those people, I think two issues. Number one is that may be changing. And COVID may have been a massive catalyst for that because I know, I mean, just in my experience down in Florida, many of the folks who I speak to who would consider themselves or did consider themselves apolitical, now they understand, oh, man, it really makes a difference whether you live in New Jersey or in Florida because your governor and the other officials in your state really determine this stuff, and it's not haphazard. Like it's not a coincidence that Abbott and DeSantis have one view of COVID restrictions, and Newsom and Cuomo had another. It makes sense. Now it's catalyzing for people that these political issues have real resonance and you know, tangible effects in the real world. So I mean, in that respect, it's been very instructive. But to your other point, I think that even if someone is not necessarily connected to politics in a strong or ideology in a strong explicit way, they still get the mood, the general basic conception, and then Bloom talked about this a lot, which is just the basic mood. Let's say, I mean, we call the mainstream media, you know, for a reason. It's because it sets the tone of what is considered, you know, quote unquote, normal. And, you know, the range of acceptable discourse, you know, within the Overton window. Today, especially, there are a whole bunch of assumptions about human nature and government and politics that even someone who's apolitical, that's in the back of their brain. You think like, oh, you know, I am pro LGBTQ, you know, whatever it is today, because I think that that makes me a better person or a virtuous person or a kind person, et cetera. And what ends up happening is, a friend of mine calls it intellectual log rolling, which is, you know, once you kind of accept one or two of their, ideological conceptions, eventually the others will follow, because it's a kind of, you know, semi-coherent system, let's say, on both sides. So you're pushed to want to accept, if you are pro-choice and you spend a lot of time with folks who are on the right, you get to be more receptive to the pro-life arguments, and I think it's like that on every issue, and it kind of quietly and slowly may seep in even without people's knowledge. So I think people are more. I think people are more political than they even know they are, because they have ideas about issues that maybe are unexamined. Actually, most of the time they're unexamined.
Yes.
But they are political issues nonetheless. I mean, whether or not they vote on them, that's a different issue.
Totally.
Yeah.
Big time different. Since about, historically, through most of our lives, we're not that old. 50% of America or more never even bothered to vote. So, could not be bothered to show up even one day out of every 4 years. And that tells me something. I had a friend who immigrated here from Iran back in the 90s. And he said to me, you know something? The fact that these people are not participating means everybody's pretty happy. It means they're not too concerned about bad things happening.
The stakes are low.
Yeah. Therefore, for most of our lives, we are programmed to trust our institutions, nothing really bad's going to happen. I saw a tweet that one of my friends put out. He's up in Canada, experiencing a different kind of response to COVID and everything else. And it's a picture of like this, you know, happy, shining, beaming couple in the 1980s. It says, my parents in their 30s, we think we'll buy a house.
Yes.
And it says, you know, me today is like this guy who looks like he's totally frazzled and starving. He's like, waiting for the next chapter of Revelation to unfold, you know? So it was a different time. And now you look back, we I'm sure took for granted so much of what was given to us by the previous generations, who are being so demonized by people who want to tear down, not build up, tear down what that was and the peace you ever had. I am out of time. I have no choice but to get to break, and I'm going to do it. I'm talking to David Reboy, and he is the author of National divorce is expensive, but it's worth every penny. This is not a book that requires 50 years or, you know, 50 hours to read. This is on his website, Late Republic Nonsense. You can read it in probably about 10 minutes, maybe less if you're me. Okay, no, it's fantastic. Check it out. I have to get to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show, and I'm talking to David Reboy. He is the founder of Late Republic Nonsense, and he wrote a piece called National Divorce is Expensive, but it's Worth Every Penny. Subtitle: The National Divorce Discussion Prepares the Ground for Crucial Thinking About What Comes Next in America as the Country Grows Ever More Divided, Bitter, and Angry.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, it was a riveting read, a great read, wide circulation. And so I was saying, I just came from California, where people are actually having the same discussion. And one of them mentioned a certain conservative talk show host, who shall remain nameless for now, and said, hey, this person had a great idea. Let us separate the country and, you know, we'll just do it nicely. We'll just say, guys, you go do what you want to do, and we'll go do what we want to do, and states can decide, and that's it. And so I'm thinking to myself, wasn't that how the Civil War started? Wasn't that how the American Revolutionary War started? It didn't start with people taking to the streets and shooting each other. That's not where it all got started. People actually said, I know, let us all agree to write down on a piece of paper what it is we think and feel, and let us say, especially if we are the militarily weaker power of the half, let us say, hey, how about you go your way, we'll go ours, and here's why we're offended, but why fight? Let's just break up. And that was tried in our history, and I think that's important. I know that's not recent history, but still, it is the British common law tradition, which we still have. So our laws are very similar in some ways to what we were working with at the time. And, you know, it's not the people who want to leave who get aggressive. It's the people who say, excuse me, you think you're going to walk off with half the wealth, half of my subjects that I tax, half of my strategic or your geopolitical positioning in the world? I don't think so. Okay, so as you say in your article, the red half of the country really isn't too interested in pushing its views onto the blue side. But the blue side emphatically is interested in pushing itself onto the red side. So what happened? You know, I was again fantasizing. I thought, what happens if the blue side said, you know what, we hate fossil fuels. So you guys take all the oil producing states, the coal states, the natural gas states. It's 36 states total. Man, that would be amazing. That'd be a dream come true. We would produce more than OPEC, first of all. I'm so serious. No one in OPEC can touch even West Texas oilfield Permian alone. This would be a dream come true. But they're not going to do that. It's just not going to happen. Okay, so what do you think, David? Is there... I know you don't have a crystal ball. But what can an amicable divorce possibly look like?
Look, I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's... I'm trying to think what could it look like. I mean, you know, the truth of the matter is that every 4 or 8 years when there's a change of political party, you see folks talking about this. You know, there were folks talking about some of the West Coast states splitting off after Trump was elected. Obviously, it's not going anywhere because the ties are too strong. And they realize, like, why should we go? We can destroy him because we own the federal government.
Yeah, yeah, right.
As you said, I mean, we don't have, let's say the red states have a lot of leverage, you know, in that case, if they wanted to use it. As you know, as I've been saying the whole time, we need autonomous institutions. So there are things that that we don't have that we need to build up. But even without that, I think the conversation is helpful because it reorients the way maybe, hopefully, helpfully, it will reorient the way people will maybe take this union for granted and take these dynamics, these relationship dynamics for granted. It does worry me that, let's say, the Biden administration is not at all concerned about, you know, about the state of our disunion. I mean, one of the things that it's set out to do immediately, I mean, it created, you know, without getting into the whole, you know, the whole separate issue, but it jumped on the January 6th issue as a way to expand the definition of homegrown domestic terrorism and expand homeland security in a very, very partisan ideological way targeted against fellow Americans.
Right.
And they knew exactly what they were doing. And they kind of keep pushing this. They keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And you would think that a wise government or wise leadership who would be in this position, and they would say, you know what, it's the paramount job of a statesman to keep what is now a cold civil war, as Angela Codevilla said, from going hot.
Right.
And there are things that you could do. I mean, this has always been the paradox of the left, which is in let's say the Democrat Party as it is today. The way they see foreign affairs is the way they see domestic affairs.
Yes. Yes.
And it's exactly the same. So
yes.
So it's like they're domestic and you know, they have no foreign, they really have no foreign enemies or adversaries. They have foreign projections of domestic enemies. So they have, you know, foreigners that remind them of right-wingers at home.
Okay,
we hate them.
Let me counter you for just a second.
Okay.
Let me challenge you. I'm going to say it's the other way around. I'm going to say an Obama brings in a Valerie Jarrett. Okay, let's start with Obama. Raised in Indonesia, not the United States. His reference points are not saluting the flag in school, you know, and singing God Bless America. No, he grew up in, you know, what was a theocracy, albeit considered to be one of the lighter-handed theocracies, all the same. Valerie Jarrett, critical years in Iran. Again, she wasn't saluting the flag in Iran. Then David Axelrod, parents from Russia. You know, immediate past history. You know, I mean, I'm like 10th generation American. I think he's first.
I'm first.
You're first. So,
but
no offense.
But my parents are my parents are a little different.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Your family had a bit of a different history.
Yes.
With dictatorships and fascism in Europe. So you're not too far removed. In other words, you had people in your life who told you firsthand.
Yes.
People who you trusted, who you loved, who told you this really happened. So you can believe it. I don't know what David Axelrod's family's told him. But it might be quite the opposite for all I know.
Right.
Because this is during the Cold War, for crying out loud. And then I could keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the people who, in that particular administration, which still has quite the influence, right? Susan Rice is back. Their ideas are not America's bad and project out. It's we came from somewhere else where ideas about rule of law, particularly individual rights, freedom, even things like enforcement of contract, which is critical to a functioning capitalist society. You know what? In some parts of the world, that's just not the way it works. And so for them, hey, it's kind of a free-for-all. They can bring to the table whatever in the heck they want. And it's completely foreign to you and me because it's literally foreign. Now, I don't know about the Biden's people aren't the same team exactly.
Yeah, it's like the C team version of the Obama people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally. Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you. I think we're maybe saying different things. But
maybe.
I agree with you. I agree with you about that. The point that I was making was about perceptions of enemies.
Yes.
Foreign and domestic.
Yeah.
With the left, you know, with the way they see some countries as Democrats and other countries as Republicans. And the flavor of today is Hungary. They really, really hate the Hungarians, in a way that, you know, they really, really used to hate the Israelis, especially when Netanyahu was prime minister. And they just look at it and it reflects. But you would think that, you know, going back, you would think that they would be alarmed about the state of our disunion. Because they certainly know, you know, I mean, they press the buttons, to encourage it rather than discourage it. So in some level, they have an awareness of that. There's definitely a role that they play. I would be curious to talk to a fair-minded person on the left. And, you know, a fair-minded person on the left would have to say, yes, you have legitimate grievances. Let's see how we can work this out. But I think, you know, as you said, there's, you know, our concept of federalism has been so demonized that, you know, you say federalism and they'll, you know, shoot back, you know, weird stuff about the 1860s and the Civil War. You just have to kind of, you know, scratch your head and you know, they think it is illegitimate to have states play more of a role in defining life for its citizens. So in that respect, I mean, it's really, it's kind of winner take all. You know, either, you know, one side or the other will prevail.
I agree. And I always said the big difference between the two parties, I try to explain this to people, is one side, their every move is to consolidate power and money in D.C. The other side, their every move, at least in the platform, is to decentralize power and money. So, you know, that's how I view almost every issue fits that description for me. And so government is, as Elon Musk says, the biggest corporation. It has a monopoly on legal violence. So which side would you like? The side that wants to move power away from you and into their hands in D.C., or the side that wants to decentralize to the state and local government? So that's at least one way of looking at it. But you know what? To get the full throttle, unadulterated grade A, David Reboy take, please check out at Late Republic Nonsense.
At Substack.
At Substack.com by Dave Reboy. Or you know what? Just check out the Twitter. Go to the Twitter and follow at Dave Reboy. DaveReaboi. Reaboi. There you can read National Divorce is Expensive, but it's Worth Every Penny by David Reboy. David, thanks so much for coming by.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Of course. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.